who would be willing to share what they picked up, not the story itself, but what they picked up as far as the therapeutic value of this story, that it elicited emotion or a new perspective or modeled a new behavior or all of the above? Who'd be just willing? All of the above? Okay. Okay, let me, so what's your first name? Okay, no, your first name.
Jackie.
Okay, so Jackie was saying it was all of the above. What was the emotional state that it elicited?
Fear.
Okay, so, oh, this is interesting. So it embodied, so the story embodied and therefore elicits in the listener, embodied going from fear to?
A choice,
yeah,
of protection.
Well, what would be the other emotion? Is there another emotion? Is it safety or it was safety? Okay. So what Jackie would do is say, okay, this story embodies a shift from fear to the feeling of safety. Okay. What sorts of therapeutic problems, issues involve going from fear to safety? What'd you come up with? Did you get a chance to? I don't have to put you. Okay, so remember we talked first about a solution in search of a problem, which is you've got your story, you identified, oh, this embodies all these types of shifts. Now, what kind of treatment problems could I use this on? Now let's talk about the problem that this would be a good solution for. What kind of treatment issues might involve going from fear to the feeling of safety? Okay, abuse. So maybe the fear of all relationships will be hurtful to, oh no, many of them can feel safe. Good. What else? Pardon? Okay, yes. A pre-op patient. So they're all anxious. Maybe telling a story that involves going from nervousness and fear to calm and serenity. Good. Now what about, yes? Basically, any change. Yeah, exactly. Post-traumatic stress. So much about post-traumatic stress is learning it's safe now. You don't have to be constantly vigilant. Now, you can say that to a person. That always works really well, right? Or you can do visualizations and stories which elicit that state shift. Okay, So you're with me. It sounds like you get the gist of it. Who had a perspective shift that their story embodied? Like a new way of looking at something. Anybody? Let's see. How about the gentleman with the hat? Yes. Just what was the perspective shift?
The perspective was the adults were trying to solve the problem, which is opening the chest of the box, and the child did it because of this perspective and was able to see the problem from a very different angle.
Actually, can you I don't want to repeat it because this is good.
Well, the story had to do with a treasure chest that people were coming from very far away to open, and no one was able to. No power, no scientific knowledge, nothing was able to. But a child walks up and opens the treasure chest because that embodies a whole different shift in perspective. One that at the beginning one would toss aside and minimize, oh, a child can't do it. But it was precisely that did it. Perfect. So what we could say is sort of the bigger picture. So the direct perspective might be adult perspective versus child perspective, okay? And the so-called less advanced, less developed perspective is actually what solves the problem. You could use it in a bigger frame by dealing with any type of situation where a person thinks, I don't have it within me to deal with a problem because I'm not smart enough, scientific enough, educated enough. And what's symbolized in the story is it's already in you. You don't have to add on anything. You get what I'm saying? So good. So any questions about mining the therapeutic gold, if you will, in your stories? Yeah.
Do you respond that it's better to depersonalize the story?
Okay, good question. Somebody asked me that during the exercise. Do you find it better to depersonalize the story? It's a judgment call. The advantage of telling the story in first person, you know, that it happened to you, is it makes that human connection. However, there are times when, let's say if it's a story that maybe paints you not in such a great light. Not, what? Not in the sense that you're pretending, like obviously I told you some stories that don't make me look terribly impressive. I don't mean that type of story, but let's say there's something you're really struggling with in the present. Let's say you're not doing a relationship really well. Whatever it is, that you don't want to share in the first, at least I don't think you want to share in the first person. You might say, a very close friend of mine, because hopefully you're a very close friend of yours. If not, I have a story for you. No. So just say a friend of mine and then tell the story. I think also, and a question over there during the exercise was, you know, do people get kind of annoyed, like, I. I think part of that really has to do with getting clear on your intent. Are you telling the story because you don't have any friends here, so you need to tell your story to somebody? Or is it clearly telling the story for that person's benefit? So that part of the intention in storytelling is, if it's a fun story or a captivating story, that's important because you don't want the person to fall asleep on you. So you want some drama. But drama in itself isn't enough. You want to have intention. Why am I telling this story? What sorts of shifts am I hoping to catalyze? And be real clear, am I telling this just because I want to tell the story or it makes me look good, or am I telling it truly for the person? And my experience and my belief is if you tell it for the person, then there isn't that sense like, I don't want to hear about your family and your kids and, you know. Yeah. Other questions about this?
Yeah. I can sometimes see resistance cropping in the stories, because when you tell the story, the person that you're telling it to might think, oh, this doesn't apply to my life at all, and might tell you that. So how do you introduce a story to minimize resistance?
Good question. How do you minimize a story? Minimize a story. Minimize. Tell a boring one. That'll minimize it. How do you minimize resistance? There are a couple different ways. One is, if it's a real life story, you might simply, if it's somebody who seems to be really, it's like super concrete, okay, you want to try to make sure your stories are at the concrete level close enough to what their situation is so they can see the connection. A simple, this will probably sound so simple, it's like, you know, no kidding, but a simple way of just introducing a story is simply saying, you know, that reminds me, and then tell your story. And the key is, don't tell it like, once upon a time there was a little dog. You know, tell it in your normal everyday, like you're hanging out with your friends, tone of voice. Okay? So simply, that reminds me. Now if the person says, that has nothing to do with, you know, why are you telling me that? What I do is, and this also has to do with made-up stories, is I will say to people, you know, one of the ways I found most helpful in helping people change and grow is storytelling. And the reason why is the thing that gets us caught so often and stuck is our conscious mind. Isn't that true? You know, we think we can't do something. We say, I'll never be able to make this change, or I'm not good enough, or whatever. The unconscious mind is really your key so often to growth and healing. And what I've found is many times your conscious mind says, I can't do anything, but but what it needs is your unconscious mind to unlock the door. And what happens, and this is what's so cool about storytelling, is the more you tell stories and you set up a context in which the person is always looking for meaning. I had this experience with a colleague of mine who also attended a therapeutic storytelling seminar that I did. And this was several years ago. He had a heart attack. And he had a really fun and funny sense of humor. So I was hoping to elicit humor. So I sent him this really funny, it was actually a birthday card.
And it was one of those birthday cards that have, they have like a black and white still from a 1940s or 50s movie, one of those. And the scene was, there were two women, and one was looking at a birthday cake with all these candles and really flipping out. And the word balloon of her was, "Oh my God, another birthday." And there's this like really mean looking woman scowling at her with like contempt and disgust. You open up the card. I'll give you the Disney version of what it said. You open up the card and it said, "Just deal with it, baby." So I thought, he'll love this. This will cheer him up. Get a laugh at him. So I sent him the card. A couple weeks later, calls me up. Says, "David, I just want to let you know how much I appreciated that card." And I'm thinking, like, what card? Oh, that's right. Yeah. I was so depressed. I was feeling like my life was over. There was nothing I could do. And then I looked at the card and it was like, "That's right. Just deal with it, baby." Like, good. So what happens is the more you use stories, the more it creates a sense of mystery, and not like you're doing a power trip or you're playing, you remember the Kung Fu TV show? Everything is like symbolic and a metaphor. Like, grasshopper, why is it the water falls down as opposed to up? You know, it's not like that. But it creates that search for new meaning and understanding. Okay? So you get a lot more leverage when you create that context. Okay. Now, this is actually a nice segue into how might you actually, I want to give you a chance to see it in action. And what I want to do is, there are two major types of metaphors that I've used over the years. One is like the type I've been telling you, that they're kind of short, peppy anecdotes from everyday life. Now I want to give you a chance to experience a more mythic or epic, sort of hypnotic story. And when you tell short, peppy stories, it's just like, "Well, that reminds me of," and then you tell the story. Personally, the more long, drawn-out, hypnotic stories, I personally feel more comfortable when a person's eyes are closed. It's just, you might be fine if your eyes are open. It just takes some of the heat off of me. Basically, that's why. And I think also what it does is, for the long, drawn-out ones, it really allows them to go into a nice hypnotic trance and do some really powerful, deep work. So here's the deal. What I want to do is give you a demonstration of that, and to do that, to actually, for you to see it in action, if we could have somebody who has some type of limiting belief that keeps them stuck, they feel stuck about, or there's something in their life, there's a career change or anything change that they feel fearful about, and they just feel like they don't have what it takes to make that shift. So anything that you feel stuck about, either belief or life experience, and that you're willing to come up here and hear a story as a client. You don't have to tell, if you can just say what your issue is, you don't have to go into detail, just because we're going to do a quick, I want to get a sense of somebody to work with that'll be manageable, okay? Okay, so who has an issue? What? And we're doing like casting here. What's your issue?
Career change.
Career change, okay.
Trying to convince an adolescent that his head stuff is affecting his body.
Okay, trying to convince an adolescent that his head stuff is his body stuff. Okay, one other. Yes.
Trying to transition from a work relationship to a friend relationship.
Okay, transition from a work relationship to a friend relationship. Okay. I'm going to go with career. No offense. But here's the good news. Here's your choice. Your choice is, you can watch this as an observer and say, "Okay, why did he do this? Oh, I like this device. Maybe he could have done this a little better if he did such and such." You can watch the nuance. Or if you want, especially if you got voted out, you can just hear it as the recipient and just kind of close your eyes and get into it. Okay? Now, for those of you who are observing, I want you to hurry up and write down these things if you haven't. And just notice, ask yourself, what am I trying to do here? What am I trying to elicit? Okay? So, what's your name?
Mike.
Mike, do you want to come on up here? That was part of the deal. Is that okay? Coming up here? It's okay? Okay. So. Oh, he'll sign right here.
First
one. That's good. We are Johnny on the spot. Okay, so you're all set with this overhead? Because it's going to be shining on me. Okay? Oh, yeah. Alrighty. Okay. Well, hey. How you doing? Alrighty. Okay, so can you, if you could just state in like a sentence or two again what the issue is.
Midlife changing from one type of clinical practice to
being in midlife and changing from one type of clinical practice to a radically different type of clinical practice.
Okay. And I'm trying to make this as real life as possible. Do you have a sense of what the fear is about and that you feel comfortable sharing with all these people in our office?
Thanks for making me comfortable. I think there's several fears. There's fears of what will people say, what will my colleagues think. There's the fear of how am I going to pull it off. There's financial fears. There's all kinds of fears.
Okay. One of the ways, since we've never worked together before, one of the ways that I find in helping people work with fear and other issues that are holding them back is through using therapeutic storytelling. And basically, the gist of it is that what we'll be doing, if it's okay with you, is you just basically close your eyes and listen. And what I do is I tell you a story that isn't really designed for your conscious mind. It's designed for your unconscious mind. And what you find is that your unconscious mind is a tremendous source, not just of healing, but also potential. And so what you'll notice is, as I tell you this story, your conscious mind might be thinking, what's this have to do with me? Why is he telling me this? While your unconscious mind makes your own personal meanings out of the story and understandings. And as I mentioned before, I think of my role as more of a prep cook and you're the chef. But I'll just present some images, some thoughts, some ideas, and you put it together at an unconscious level in a way that works for you. Does that sound fair enough? Great, okay. So your eyes are already closed. You can just go ahead and settle on in. And as you do that, just to notice how you're feeling inside, notice the breathing. And this story takes place in the waiting area of a business. And it's a woman in her early 40s, and she's pacing back and forth, and it's 8:15. You see, her boss told her to be there at 8 o'clock sharp because he had some things he needed to get squared away with her. And now it's 8:15. And she can hear him laughing and joking with somebody else inside his office. And she feels that frustration because She doesn't like what's going on. She doesn't like how she's being treated. And yet she feels like she has no choices. And so she comes here again for yet another meeting to be yelled at. And even if your conscious mind knows what it's like to feel that way or doesn't know what it's like to feel that way, your unconscious mind makes connections in ways that are most useful for you. That's right. And now it's 8:25. She looks at her watch. And she's still waiting. And as she's waiting, she's thinking about her life. And why am I in this situation? You see, she's worked her whole life for this man, straight out of high school. And on one hand, she hated him because he's been so mean. On the other hand, she felt lucky just to have a job. Who is she to think she could find something better than this? And every time he'd say something really abusively or demeaning to her, she would tell her friends and they'd say, "You can do it. You can do something better than this." And she'd just kind of smile sadly because she knew they were just trying to encourage her. They didn't know that she didn't have what it took. You see, she was a bookkeeper for this man for over 20 years. But what she always dreamed of being was a writer. And every day she went to work as a bookkeeper, it was like that little part of her that dreamed of becoming a writer died a little more. And now it's 8:30 and she's thinking, how did I end up this way? What happened? And she picked up a paper to try to keep her mind off what was happening, and there she saw it. Headline said, "Fire breaks out in circus," and then said some small town in the northwest. And in a flash, she was a little girl because she loved the circus. It was the only time she felt alive. It was the only time where she felt that passion welling up inside of her. You see, she was one of those little girls or those little children that had so much potential, but because of the situation, that potential didn't flower. Teachers would say, "Oh, she has so much potential," and they'd see her creative writing stories, and they'd say, "I don't know what it is." But see, they didn't know that when they were doing algebra, they were doing history. She was reliving last night's battle between mom and dad. But the only time she left that behind was at the circus. She loved the circus because that's where people came alive. That's where people lived lives of passion. She saw people doing all sorts of odd, unusual things. Trapeze artists, sword swallowers, the strong man, all sorts of bizarre and unusual things that they would do, but they were alive. And year after year, she'd go to the circus just to feel alive. And the circus hands would come by, and they could just see the light in her, but they could also just see the sadness. And they tried to invite her in and have her be part of it. And they would let her come back when nobody else could come. They'd let her wander around the grounds. And she would always find herself going to the elephants because she loved the elephants. Because they were so big and strong, they could do anything. And one day she went around to look for the elephants, and there was her favorite elephant. And she couldn't believe the sight. Because there was this elephant with a rope around its leg, and the rope was tied to a stake in the ground, and the elephant would pull against the stake and it would stop. And she looked at the elephant, and she was trying to make sense out of what she was seeing. And then one of the old circus hands came up behind
behind her. And the voice of many years of life said, I know what you're wondering, but it's not what you think it is. You see, when this elephant was little, she was tied with a wire on that leg. And that rope that you see, it isn't a super strong rope. It isn't a stake that's pounding so deep in the ground. It's that when she was little and she tried to escape, the wire bit into her leg. And it hurt. And she learned that you can't break free. And so, even though really she can't, because that knowing is there. And as the little girl heard the wisdom of what he said, she felt a sinking feeling in her heart, not just for the elephant, but for about herself, because there had been a part of her that hoped that maybe someday she could break free and be a writer. And the truth was there. And now it's 8:40 and she's walking back and forth, and there's this flashback is stirring up those feelings of helplessness and hopelessness and the sadness. And that's when she saw the sentence. And the sentence in the paragraph, in the article, in the newspaper, talking about the fire breaking out early in the morning before dawn, several of the circus hands being brought to the hospital for smoke inhalation, many of the animals treated, but the elephants broke free. And with that, she put down the paper, she put on her coat, and she walked out. And as you feel the story, that's right, and as you think about the story, to know that your conscious mind can be making conscious connections, and your unconscious mind can be making other connections. And what you also can look forward to is many healing dreams in the days and weeks to come. And I don't know if you'll notice an emotional shift when you start to think about this, or if the emotional shift will happen and you'll start to be doing the things that you had been afraid of, and you say, wait a minute, I used to not think I could do this, but I've broken free. So it will be an interesting and exciting journey as this part of your journey, discovering the tremendous healing and growing power of your unconscious mind and how it fits into your bigger journey. And when your unconscious mind agrees to continue to work on this at your own pace to come back out. Do you mind if people ask us questions? Is that okay? Yeah. Okay. One thing that you'll notice, and this is in a regular clinical context, I never say, so what did you think? Or, what did it mean to you? The whole idea of metaphor is to work at the unconscious level. It's like some famous dancer choreographer, after the performance, somebody said, I loved your dance. What were you trying to say? She said, if I could have said it, I wouldn't have had to dance it. So yeah, you don't want to process it. It's a very delicate kind of experience. You want the person's unconscious mind to be working on it.
So do you have questions for me or any questions for Mike as far as what was it like? Or why did you do this? Or anything that you noticed that you think it's helpful to point out to others? Yes?
Projecting my own tragedy.
Okay, so repeat the question, yes. So this lady was saying that her elephant died in the story, okay? So that's where it's an interactive kind of thing. If you see some type of strong emotional response, that's when you do want to check in, like, can I just check in what's happening here? Yeah, I've done that. Yeah, if it's a real strong emotional response that's not what you had expected, it's fine to check in, and you might just bag the story and start doing either hypnotic work or regular therapeutic, traditional therapy. Yeah. Other questions or comments? Do you notice it was a story wrapped around a story? Why did I do that? Pardon? Right, it goes deeper. It's a hypnotic phenomenon. When you stack stories, if you will, or embed stories. What else? Any else, other questions or observations?
One of the things I noticed when you first started telling the story, my conscious mind was that, why is he telling me this? Why the waiting room? Why the woman pacing? Why a woman? All these things. And then all of a sudden I found that with that distraction, I was actually going into trance deeper. And it's like, well, maybe that's what he's doing. Oh, that's what it is.
That's great. And that's good. It's especially if you're working with somebody who's very bright, very analytical, use lots of confusion to keep them busy.
It works.
You don't, if it's somebody who comes from a super dysfunctional background and lots of confusing messages, you don't want to be confusing because you don't want to get a flashback. Another question.
How important is it that the person you are telling, you told a story about a woman, mm-hmm.
Okay, how important it is. I often do the opposite sex just as a way to offer a little extra distance, a little extra politeness or emotional safety. Okay. Let's see. We've got 6 more minutes. Yes.
To give you a chance to hear a different type of metaphor, a more mythical, archetypal story, I'm going to close this tape off with another metaphor, which actually was from the presentation that started off this audio tape. And as you listen to the story, I encourage you to be thinking about both stylistic aspects of it, as well as what types of therapeutic goals, therapeutic issues might you use this story for.
Now this tale takes place, as they all so often do, many years ago in a faraway land, in a village at the base of a mountain range. And there's a little boy in this village named Kaler, who lived with his family, his 3 older brothers, his mother and his father. Kaler's brothers were the brightest, the bravest, the handsomest young men in the village. And then there was Kaler. Kaler was little. He was born with a club foot. He limped throughout the village. And he knew how pathetic he was. And he would look at his brothers, and he would look upon himself with contempt. And how often do we do that as children and perhaps even as adults as we compare? And Kaler did as much as he could to be invisible in this village. He would stay upon the edge when children were playing. If he had an idea, he would never share it. He was truly invisible. Whilst Kaler was living his drama, another drama was unfolding, as it had been for many generations, as so often is the case in another time. This drama was about a mountain lizard. 100 years hundreds and hundreds of years before, had crawled into a cave and in the darkness had transformed into a dragon. Weary travelers seeking shelter in the cave, all that remained of them were the memories in the hearts of their loved ones. Brave warriors seeking to slay the dragon, their spears and shields were littered about the cave floor. One day, Taylor's father and his brothers decided that because they were the bravest warriors in the village, that they would slay the dragon. And they gathered their weapons and their gear together. And Taylor knew his place. And don't we all, so many times? He was the pathetic one in the family. He would stay home. But what he didn't know was how inside of each of us is a glowing ember waiting to be fanned into a flame. And he didn't know what fanned that ember into a flame, but he found himself standing taller than he ever had before, and his voice grew deeper, and he said, "I am going with you." His brothers and his father looked at him with contempt and said, "Are you kidding? You will slow us down, and you know that." And the flame burned brighter. And Taylor stood even taller and said, "No, I am going with you." And they looked in his eyes and they saw that he was going with them. And it took them longer than usual, as it undoubtedly would, because he couldn't walk as fast as them. But they made it up into the mountains, and they came to the cave, and they knew it was the cave, even without the map, because there were bones and spears and shields strewn about. And they prepared, the father and the brothers, because Taylor would stay outside the cave, they prepared for their assault the next day. That night, the brothers and the father had nightmares of being chased. And how often do we have those nightmares? And what is chasing us? Taylor's night was different. He had a healing dream. And what are those healing dreams that you are ready to have as you go deeper into your experience, and you can find yourself thinking about a lot of different things? You can follow the story. You can go into your own story. You can think about many different things. And in that dream, Taylor became an eagle, and he flew high above the village, and he saw this little invisible boy who was hiding from life, and he realized what was possible. Now when he woke up, he didn't remember his healing dream, but there was something happening inside, and you'll notice that as your healing dreams unfold, that there's a feeling shift. Well, the brothers and the father got ready, got their gear together, their weapons, and they went into the cave. And it was your typical cave. It was dark. It was damp. There were spiders and snakes and rats. And it was far from pleasant. And they walked and they walked and they walked. And they came around a bend in the tunnel. And there was a huge cavern and a lake. And there must have been hole in the roof, for there was one single shaft of sunlight sparkling upon the water like diamonds. And far off, at the far edge of the lake, was the dragon. It was larger than an elephant. It was more ferocious looking, more fearsome looking, more frightening than any monster in any nightmare. And as they saw the dragon, they realized that today was not the day to slay the dragon. And so they turned and they ran. And they ran and they ran. And the oldest brother was so frightened that he dropped his spear and his shield, and it broke the spell. And the dragon looked up, for the dragon had been staring at the glittering sunlight. The dragon looked up and he saw them and he charged. And although he was larger than an elephant, he was faster than a horse. And he ran after them. And they could feel the heat from the flame from his mouth. And they ran and they ran. And they came to the edge, the opening of the cave, and they ran out into the sunlight, for they had forgotten the legend. And the dragon stopped within the cave, for it had not. Being who they were, they didn't talk about their shame and about their fear. Instead, they looked at Caleb and said, "Now, because of you, it's going to take us twice as long to go back to the village and get more weapons." And how often have the shame of the elders been passed on to those of the next generation? And in what ways? Caleb looked at them with a big smile and said, "You go on without you. I'll be here. There's plenty of food. I'll see you when you come back." And they left with scowls. And he found himself walking around the meadow, not sure why he was doing this. Have you ever found yourself doing something and you're not sure why, but it feels right? And he reached down and he picked up a crystal that was glittering in the sunlight. And he put it in his pouch where he always kept his fishing twine. And then he saw the eagle feather. And he put that in his pouch. And not knowing why he was doing this, he dreamed another dream that night about the eagle feather, about the crystal, and about the little boy in the village who had hidden from life for so many years. And the next morning, still not knowing exactly why, but listening to what felt right, he walked into the cave, and it was the same cave of his brothers and his father. And he walked and he walked, and he rounded the bend, and it was the same huge cavern, the lake, the sunlight glittering upon the water, and the same fearsome, frightening dragon, the far edge of the lake. And the dragon was staring at the glittering sunlight upon the water. And Caleb, not knowing why he was doing this, he took the eagle feather, he took the crystal, and he bound them together with the fishing twine, and he tossed them out. And it clattered against the cave floor. And the dragon looked up, and he saw the crystal, and he was once again mesmerized by the glittering sunlight upon the crystal. And you see, Caleb was not fleet of foot like his brothers and his father. Remember, he had a club foot. So he could not run. He could only walk. But because he walked quietly. And the dragon never heard him and never saw him. And Caleb let out all the fishing twine that he had, and he walked right out into the sunlight with the dragon following behind him, like a kitten following a toy on a string. Caleb went out into the sunlight, for he had remembered the legend. The dragon, captivated by the glittering crystal, had forgotten. And they're out in the sunlight, and Caleb's looking up at this dragon. And what is that dragon symbolizing? And as he's staring at the dragon, there's an explosion and a puff of smoke. And Caleb is flattened to the ground. And when he gets up, all that's in front of him is a scrawny little mountain lizard. And at that moment, Caleb's brothers and his father came up over the rise, and they saw the scrawny mountain lizard. And being who they were, they said, "Let's kill it." Caleb said, "Don't you remember the legend? What happens to the dragon when it sees the light of day, and what can never happen again?" And he looked on with a feeling of sadness and a feeling of gratitude as he saw the little lizard scurrying off. And as he made his way home, he found himself thinking about what he had learned in the cave and what you learn in the daylight and what that can mean for your life. And he found himself seeing images in his mind of how his life was now going to be different because he could no longer deny what he had always known. And you can dream about this story. You can dream about it in your own way. Because even though I told the story, it's your story, your unique story.
Now, just in case it wasn't obvious, you'll notice the tempo in the story is much slower than the tempo of the stories that I told at the presentation. And that's because people were listening to the story in a, you know, their eyes were closed and they were hopefully in a light hypnotic trance. And I think one of the benefits of telling stories in a hypnotic trance is they tend to impact deeper because the person's accessing more primary process thought. It also gives them a chance to you take more time to elicit the emotions because the whole process is slowed down. That's also why the concept of primary process thought, why more mythical archetypal stories can oftentimes be more powerful because they're mythical, because they're symbolic and deal with a more a less logically based thought process. They tend to elicit primary process thought, which tends to bring up more unconscious material. If you're interested in getting a handout on hypnotic language patterns and how to integrate them into your stories to increase their power and precision, just give me a call at the number on the label of the audio tape, and I'll send the handout to you. If you have email, that would be even better yet, and to leave a message what your email address is, and I'll get that right out to you. I hope you found this helpful.